The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
Good afternoon. I'm Jack Stein, filling in for Mr. Dory Monson. Always an honor and a pleasure to keep the seat warm for Mr. Monson. Big lead today, as everybody knows, going on with the mass exodus at SPD. We're also going to be getting to that presidential town hall, if you want to call it that. But let's get to the big lead.
The big lead, big local.
Ladies and gentlemen, special guest in the studio, Jason Rantz from KTTH. You can hear him every Monday through Friday on the Jason Rantz Show. Jason, how are you, sir? Tell me what is going on with this mass exodus.
Oh, yes. I mean, for a lot of us, we knew this was coming. We just didn't have the specific numbers. At least 118 Seattle police officers have separated from the department. I was able to confirm yesterday, September alone, as Hannah Scott just reported, 39 officers left the force. What's not being discussed here is in October so far, there have been at least 8 additional separations at a time when we now have in Seattle about 1,200 officers who are considered deployable for service, which is a little bit misleading because they're not all actually deployable, but going with that, that would be the lowest the city has seen in about 2 decades. So there are some significant concerns about the safety of the community when you have so few officers who are actually out there able to be on patrol. The vast majority of the officers who have separated, which includes, you know, lateral moves to other agencies and retirements, that means right now most of them are actually coming from the patrol unit. And that's dangerous.
I was looking at some crime statistics. This has got to be about a month ago, and it was from the 2019 kind of overall. Let's pool all this information together. And the thing that I found, the number that really stuck out to me, was there's about 800,000 911 calls made in a year and roughly 1,200 officers to go and deal with that. So if you just the intense amount of action, if you want to call it that, that happens in Seattle – and the amount of attention that it needs, and now you have guys and women who are saying, I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to be, I don't want to be the next headline. I don't want to be the next Derek Chauvin, if you want to call it that. I don't want to put myself and my family potentially at risk. So I can empathize with a lot of these officers saying, I'm just not into it anymore. I don't have a city council that supports me. I don't have a mayor that supports me. So I'm just going to explore other options.
And it's not even just they don't support them. It's that in the case of certain council members, they actively fight against them. This is not simply just sort of passively sitting by, although that's the best way to probably explain Mayor Jenny Durkan. I mean, I'm just trying to get a comment from her over yesterday's instance in which a man tried to burn alive a police officer, and she says nothing. The best we'll probably get is a spokesperson giving me a comment about how bad it is. But that's not the way it's supposed to be if you actually care about your police force. They've released earlier today this data. There's no press conference today. I'm not sure why they choose to release this on a Friday where it's likely going to die over the weekend. There just is no strategy to address this issue, and this has some real-life consequences for people. Right now, priority one response times. Now, priority one calls are dangerous, in-progress crimes that you need to have an officer respond immediately. In the North Precinct, it took an average 9 minutes for someone to return a 911 call, to respond to a 911 call between July and September. Think about that. 9 minutes is astronomically high when you're waiting for a police officer to show up during an emergency. And believe me, the cops want to be able to show up within moments. Unfortunately, they're just not staffed to be able to do that. And these numbers are going to get worse. Let me tell you a little bit about what I mean when we say the numbers are a little bit misleading. So we say 1,200 officers. Well, that's 1,200 officers total, right? So right now, obviously, they're not 1,200 officers who are deployable, who are wandering around different neighborhoods, responding to 911 calls or proactively policing. But of that 1,200, there are a number of SPD officers who are burning their sick time. They're not coming in. They've accrued a lot of sick time. They're using that time right now, and they're just biding their time until they're able to go to another agency or until they retire. A number of them have reached out to me to say just that. So these numbers are actually worse, and there are fears within the department that the statistics for the separations could even hit 200 by the end of this year. And that isn't just historically high. That would be catastrophic.
Let me play devil's advocate for a second, because there are people out there who would say, well, just let them go. They don't want to be here. They can't handle the pressure. They can't just let them go, and Seattle will. It'll just deal with it, and then we'll funnel more money into various programs that can kind of sort of maybe try to help the problem. I'm not being a very good devil's advocate.
Here's why you can't be a good devil's advocate. Because that position doesn't make any sense. It lacks all logic. You know, this whole idea that the defund movement wants to put money into different programs to go at the quote-unquote root causes of the violence, that's fine. And I think that that's an important part to try to go after the root causes of the violence. However, the way they're doing it is backwards. They are assuming that just getting rid of a bunch of cops and putting the money into the programs means you're going to get immediate results. And of course, we know that that's not going to happen. What you should do is put the money into the programs, show proof of concept that these actual programs will work at cutting down violence. And then at that point, you can review the budget for the SPD or any police department. But right now, we have a 60% increase in homicides in Seattle. Right now, in King County as a whole, we've seen a larger number of domestic violence homicides than we did in the two previous years. We've seen a tremendous increase in arson. And of course, we've seen an entire explosion of homelessness in the city. So these are not good statistics, and they're not going to get any better. They're going to get much, much, much worse if this council doesn't wake up and if this mayor doesn't start getting a little bit more aggressive in fighting for police officers.
We're speaking with Jason Rantz from KTTH, weekdays 3 to 6. Jason, I think I know where this mentality comes from, the kind of anti-police mentality comes from, at a very core level. About 6 months ago, I am in my apartment. I live in a duplex, and my downstairs neighbor is having a domestic disturbance. They're loud. They're throwing things. And so I decide I'm going to call the police. So I call the police. They show up to my apartment. There's about four of them, big guys. I open the door, and they said, we heard there's a domestic dispute going on at this address. I said, no, that's actually downstairs. They said, do you mind if we come in and check? And of course, because I haven't done anything wrong, I go, oh, yeah, come on in, y'all. Just come on in. Please, you know, you're welcome in my home. And then afterwards, after they leave, Sarah says, why did you just invite those men into our home? I said, they're police. Why they're here to investigate a crime that's going on downstairs. She said, don't do that. Don't let police into our home like that. And I thought, why not? They're the good guys, right? We haven't done anything wrong. And so she and I got into a little bit of a back and forth about it. Ultimately, I won. But a point being is I think that there's this kind of natural, I don't know what you want to call it. Maybe people have been trained that way to have just this natural response to it. Almost a pathological, I don't even want them in my home kind of a mentality.
I mean, there's certainly going to be people like that, but I do not think that's what's happening in this case. I mean, you've got an army of professional activists who are out there spreading a very specific narrative, and it started a long time ago, but after George Floyd was murdered in Minneapolis, here those activists, for lack of a better term, activated, right? They turned to the streets. They got violent. They pursued a very specific agenda as if the George Floyd case happened here in Seattle. And they want people to believe that we have a bunch of police officers who are wandering the streets of Wallingford or Capitol Hill or Northgate and just wantonly shooting black people. We know that's not true. And we know that this idea of the police brutality line doesn't exist from a statistical standard here in the Seattle area or really across the country. You've got ideologues who do not like the idea of police officers, right? I mean, when we talk about defunding, let's not forget that defunding to some activists mean literally getting rid of the funding. They want to see an abolition of police officers. That is never going to happen. I wish we lived in a world in which there was no crime whatsoever. But unfortunately, I'm looking at statistics right here where we've got 40 homicides in Seattle through October alone. These people need to be caught, and we need police officers to do that. Come at me when you've got literal zeros next to rape and robbery and aggravated assault and arson, and then let's have that conversation about getting rid of all police officers. But we're not even remotely close to that point.
I don't even know what that world would look like, to be honest with you.
It would look like we would have Morlocks coming from below and pulling us pretty utopian people down into the ground. That's what would happen. There's no such thing as a utopia. Doesn't exist.
I mean, if let's just say there were no police, right? And I am there's none whatsoever. And I'm jaywalking, and I'm throwing garbage on the ground, and I'm double parked in front of a fire hydrant, and I just total, like, do whatever I want. But then all of a sudden, someone starts shooting a gun inside of a bank. They're trying to rob a bank. Who do we call at that point in time?
A social worker. Call the social workers. You know, the perfect example of how this can never work is we literally had a police-free zone known as CHOP, the Capitol Hill Occupied Protest, or CHAZ, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. And within just 3 weeks, we saw rampant crime. We saw arson. We saw a riot. We saw lots of vandalism. And of course, we saw two homicides against black teenagers. Okay? This was putting the activists calling for the defunding of the police. We put them in charge, in which policing was not happening from the city level. They created their own police force with Antifa members with guns, and we saw crime. So they can't even get a 6-block radius in order, but they think that their ideas will translate to all of Seattle. If there were no cops, we know exactly what would happen because we saw it happen. I think we lost Jack Stein from his connection. You're listening to the Dory Monson Show. You know, the best part about having a guest in the studio who's a talk show host, he could almost immediately figure it out and start to talk.
Surprise of surprises. You know, Jason, I think the other part of this that I find to be frustrating is that case where you have those officers who had apparently it was a log or a stick that was... it was a flaming piece of lumber, which if I had to guess, likely had some kind of fuel propellant on it. But this random guy throws in this piece of lumber into a cop car and burns it. So what is this world when we talk about people who say we'll defund the police and we'll get away from this this police state, they call it sometimes, or this militarized state. We'll get away from that. And I think, well, unfortunately, there's a percentage of the population. Let's ballpark it. Let's say it's 3%. Let's say it's even 1%, which has, you could call it mental illness. You could call it sociopathy. You could call it whatever you want. But they are out there to do harm to other people. At what point do we just admit, you know, we got to have guys with guns who walk around, who have the power to arrest somebody and put them in a safe box away from everybody else?
I think
at
society,
what point do we just come to that realization?
Society has that realization, right? I mean, the problem that we have here is we have ceded in this city a lot of power to a small group of radicals. And Seattle is not the only city doing this. You have the same sort of situation happening in New York, in Chicago, in Atlanta, at Portland, of course. Society accepts that we need police officers. That is just a statistical fact. You can look at all the polling. No one actually supports the defund movement the way that some of these activists will have you believe. And yet this council has decided to near exclusively talk with just those people. I mean, even in the situation yesterday with this attempted murder of a police officer, I'm told that it was someone who was homeless and mentally ill. Well, it happened right outside of Denny Park, which has been completely overrun with the homeless who have decided to camp out there in a city where, as I said, homelessness has exploded because the city will not remove the encampments. They're not putting people into programs that they need to be put into. They instead are allowed to do whatever it is they want, and cops can't do anything. We got rid of the navigation team, the specialized unit of SPD officers who would go into these encampments and connect these folks with shelters, but because they also sweep them up, it's been deemed inhumane. So we've got all of these problems getting worse because of the same policies that have been in place for years that we've decided to, in the case of Seattle, double, triple, and quadruple down on. It makes no sense.
Well, for some people, though, I think because it feels good to be able to. By the way, we're speaking with Jason Rance of KCTH.
That's me.
He's, every weekday, 3 to 6. For some people, I think it feels really good to take that kind of action, to say, well, we, you know, we're anti-police and we're pro-minority communities, which is something that a lot of people can agree on. I don't want to see anybody get hurt. I don't want to see anybody. I hate violence. I don't want to see anybody unjustly arrested or unjustly convicted of a crime. I don't want to see any of that. But for some people, they have to take it a step further where they say, no. You have to actually, you have to live that vibe. You have to be that guy who says, well, we'll defund and we'll cut everything out and then we'll go to social workers. And here we have something called the Downtown Streets Team, which walks around and picks up garbage and hands out flowers.
Well,
so.
these overwhelmingly white, progressive, socialist, anarchist, whatever you want to call them, should probably start talking to actual people of color. Because when you look at the polling across the country, communities of color are not saying get rid of cops. They might say we should do policing in a little bit different way, but they're not saying get rid of the police. You've got a lot of very, dare I say, privileged white progressives in Seattle who want to pretend that they speak on behalf of the black community, yet they don't know black people. They don't have black people a part of their movement. And the only time that they will even listen to someone of color is when they also hold some pretty fringe ideological views. Because again, the vast majority of people, regardless of their race, their gender, their religion, whatever, they say we want police. You can have the conversation, I think it's totally fair, about ways to police and places where we can maybe make some reforms. But that's not what the people on the streets in Seattle, including last night outside of Seattle University, are asking for. They are radicals. Stop listening to radicals. Start listening to the Jason Rant Show, though, weekdays from 3 to 6 on AM 770 KTTH.
Jason Rance, everybody. Jason, thank you very much for dropping by the studio. I really do appreciate it.
Absolutely.
We are going to be taking a quick break. When we get back, everything in the news right now is all Hunter Biden. It's all Joe Biden. It's all this town hall debauchery that was just kind of underwhelming, to be honest with you. But we're going to go into it nonetheless. I'm Jack Stein. I'm filling in for Mr. Dory Monson, keeping the seat warm. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Dory Monson Show. I'm Jack Stein, filling in for Mr. Monson this afternoon. I got a chance to witness the town hall. I don't even know what you want to call it at this point. It wasn't exactly it's not exactly fair to compare them in any way, shape, or form. What I saw was kind of a late night infomercial for one Joe Biden, and then I saw President Trump getting just absolutely hammered last night by Savannah Guthrie. And when I was flipping back and forth between the two, mostly focusing on President Trump, but when I would go back to the Biden and he's talking with George Stephanopoulos and they're going back and forth, I had this feeling of tension, and I couldn't describe it at the time, but I thought about it and I realized that it's the same kind of tension that I would have if I saw a child who was unsupervised walking around the edge of the Grand Canyon. There's this feeling that something just could go inevitably just wrong at any point in time. And I felt myself just being so like, oh, is he gonna pass out? Is he gonna die? I just had this weird feeling that something could go wrong at any moment. And then I would go back to Trump and he would be raging and he would be upset. So flipping between the two, I felt as if this is just seeing the media treatment is so different between the two of them. Where one is basically getting his hand held through about an hour of an interview. And if he messes something up, it's like, okay, Joe, well, here you go. We'll just feed you more answers. And then you have Trump on the other side who's just getting hammered for an hour. Who do I think did a better job? I think President Trump did a better job. I think that he showed how resilient he has been over the last 4 years to just intense media scrutiny. But let's focus on Joe Biden for a second, because there were a couple key moments that I wanted to kind of press on. So an undecided voter comes up and says that many people believe that the true demographic in this election will be black voters under the age of 30. Not because they'll be voting for Trump, but because they won't vote at all. And then he asked about the "you ain't black" comment made by Joe Biden some time ago. Here's the audio clip of that.
Many people believe that the true swing demographic in this election will be black voters under the age of 30. Not because they'll be voting for Trump, but because they won't vote at all. I myself have had this exact same conflict. So my question for you then is, besides "you ain't black," what do you have to say to young black voters who see voting for you as further participation in a system that continually fails to protect them?
Well, I say, first of all, as my buddy John Lewis said, it's a sacred opportunity and right to vote. You can make a difference. If young black women and men vote, you can determine the outcome of this election. Not a joke. You can do that.
I'm surprised he just didn't say, "Hey, come on, man. Come on, man. What are you trying to pull here, man? Come on, man." Awkward, right? Emotional appeal. So he doesn't really answer it outright. He just defaults and says, "Hey, I was friends with John Lewis." And he doesn't recognize, he doesn't address that comment at all, which is a horrible comment, by the way, to claim that someone isn't truly black unless they vote for him. It's pretty awful and despicable thing to say to anybody of any race for any reason. But he narrowly just kind of, "Hey, man, me and my buddy John Lewis. Come on, man. Me and John Lewis, we were buddies. I'm not really all that bad of a guy." And it's just continued to be kind of this confusing, awkward exchange. He got confused as to what his own website says about the Green New Deal. Here's audio of that.
A member of the Boilermakers Local 154, Sean Stephanie, was quoted in the New York Times today saying, "You can't have it both ways." It says, "You can't meet your goal to end fossil fuels without ending fracking." What do you say to people like Sean who doubt your denial because they think you want to keep that promise?
Tell them the Boilermakers overwhelmingly endorsed me, okay? So the Boilermakers union has endorsed me because I sat down with them in great detail with their leadership exactly what I would do, number one. Number two, what I would do is I would stop giving tax breaks and subsidizing oil. We don't need to subsidize oil any longer, number one. We should stop that and save billions of dollars over time. What I would also do with regard to, the difference between me and the new Green Deal, they say automatically by 2030, we're going to be carbon free. Not possible.
So are you for it or against it? You say you're not for it, but in your website it says you call it a crucial framework.
My deal is a crucial framework, but not the new Green Deal. The new Green Deal calls for elimination of all non-renewable energy by 2030. You can't get there. You're going to need to be able to transition, George.
So it's not the Green New Deal then. So he's for it, but not for that one. He's for his, which is basically the same thing, but it's actually his, so that makes it different. It's not different in any way, shape, or form. He may have removed a couple of sentences here and there, but it's effectively the same document. In fact, what was it? Last week, I printed it out. It's almost verbatim the same as what you might see on AOC's. So he should just own it. If that's what he wants, if that's what he wants to tell people, he should just own it and say, "Yep, that's what I'm for. And I think that we can do it." By the way, I'm Jack Stein. I'm filling in for Mr. Dory Monson this afternoon. The one segment that got me the most, the one that I thought was the most frustrating just for me as a citizen of these fine United States, was on packing the court, because he effectively pulled a Nancy Pelosi in reference to Obamacare. We all remember that very famous clip of Nancy Pelosi saying, in order to see what's in the bill, you need to pass the bill. And so here is the audio of him talking about packing the court.
I have not been a fan of court packing because I think it just generates what will happen. Whoever wins, it just keeps moving in a way that is inconsistent with what is going to be manageable.
So you're still not a fan?
Well, I'm not a fan. I didn't say it depends on how this turns out, not how he wins, but how it's handled, how it's handled. But there's a number of things that are going to be coming up, and there's going to be a lot of discussion about other alternatives as well.
What does that mean, how it's handled? How will that determine?
Well, for example, there's actually real live debate on the floor,
if people are really going to be able to have a time to go through this. You know, I don't know anybody who's gone on the floor and that's been a controversial justice in terms of making fundamentally altering the makeup of the court that's gone through in a day kind of thing. I mean, it depends on how much they rush this.
I don't even know what the last 30 seconds of that was even addressing in the last 20 seconds of that. I mean, it's as someone who myself suffers from a bit of dog mouth, a bit of mush mouth, someone myself who has come from a history of having a speech impediment and having to work through that my entire life, I cannot decipher what he was saying there. But this effort to kind of handhold Joe Biden through this process, I don't think it makes him look very good. But I don't think that that matters to a lot of people who are going to be voting Democrat. I think that a vote for Joe Biden is a vote against Trump. And I think that that's what they care about the most. And in fact, he even admits it himself, Joe Biden, when he says, hey, I'm a transitional candidate. I'm going to bounce in and out. I'm only going to be around for 4 years and then I'm going to take off. So he's not really what I would consider to be an inspiring figure. So people ask me, Jack, why are you so hard on Joe Biden? I feel nothing from the man. I feel no, in no way, shape, or form does he make me go, yeah, yay, America. In fact, I feel the opposite. I feel like this is a career politician who's been in the mire, in the muck, swamp, if you call it that, for 47 some odd years, and now he's coming back around again. I wasn't impressed with him when he was vice president. Still not impressed with him today. So if you want me to be on that camp of being really charged up about somebody, you picked the wrong guy. And I wonder if this is going to backfire for Democrats in a couple of weeks. I do wonder truly if he's just not the dude who can bring out the votes. If people are just going to say, oh, you know what? I will say publicly that I'm voting for Joe Biden, but in fact, I'm not even going to go to the polls. Hey, you know, I'm Jack Stein. I'm filling in for Mr. Dory Monson. I got to take a quick break. When we get back, we're actually going to be talking about Trump's half of this because he was dealing with just a completely different story. In no way was there any kind of, hey, when you say handle it, what do you mean? None of that whatsoever. Much more difficult town hall for President Trump. Going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Dory Monson Show. I am Jack Stein, filling in for Mr. Dory Monson. Keeping the seat warm, as we like to call it in the business. So Trump, we're talking about Biden, which, by the way, let me just point this out about Joe Biden's performance last night. Not a single question in regards to Hunter Biden, the scandal with the laptop and the emails and the connections to Ukraine and the money. Not a single, solitary question. And that, for me, says what? You know, I read the New York Post article. It raises a lot of questions for me as a voter, right? Raises a lot of questions. And when I see someone basically be given the soft treatment, treated like he's a child, I find that to be not, it's very disingenuous, particularly when I compare that to what happened to President Trump. And I don't know of a man who has had to say that he is not a white supremacist more who has ever existed on this planet. And I can tell you that I have known a couple of white supremacists in my day. I used to travel in pretty rough circles, and I knew a couple of them. And boy, howdy, did they love talking about white supremacy. They loved talking about it. They weren't embarrassed about it. They'd share it as much as they possibly could. And as a biracial dude, it was kind of awkward for me to be in the same room when they would talk about it. I have never known a white supremacist to not want to talk about it in some fashion. Generally, I'm pretty sure that there might be some people who kind of have clandestine views and go about their life like that. But for the most part, you talk about neo-Nazis, you talk about skinheads. These are people who want this to be known. They're not secretive in their agenda. So you have Donald Trump, who has been asked consistently for the last 4 years, hey, how do you feel about white supremacy? And he says, I don't like it. In fact, he goes so far as to say that he denounces it totally. But for all of the liberal friends that I have keep trying to tell me that Donald Trump is a white supremacist, but I don't see any of the evidence. I just don't see it whatsoever. So when he's asked last night by Savannah Guthrie about white supremacy, it gets a little awkward. It gets a little weird. Here's the audio clip of that.
You were asked point blank to denounce white supremacy. In the moment, you didn't. You asked some follow-up questions. Who specifically? A couple of days later, on a different show, you denounced white supremacy.
No,
my question to you is,
you've done this to me and everybody.
Why does it seem like...
I denounced white supremacy, okay?
You did 2 days later.
I've denounced white supremacy for years, but you always do it. You always start off with a question. You didn't ask Joe Biden whether or not he denounces Antifa. I watched him on the same basis. Basic show with Lester Holt, and he was asking questions like Biden was a child.
Well, this is a little bit of a dodge.
Are you listening? I denounce white supremacy.
Okay.
What's your next question?
Do you feel, it feels sometimes you're hesitant to do so, like you wait a beat.
Here we go again. Every time, in fact, when people came, I'm sure they'll ask you the white supremacy question. I denounce white supremacy.
Okay.
And frankly, you want to know something? I denounce Antifa, and I denounce these people on the left that are burning down our cities that are run by Democrats who don't know what...
Hesitant. Said he's hesitant to do... Can you think of a... Is that journalism? Is that a fair question? Seems like you're a little bit hesitant about that. We have a clip. We have a montage that I would like to share with all the people who might be doubting right now that if Donald Trump is, maybe he's a white supremacist, maybe he's not. We have a fun montage that Nicole has put together of all the times he's ever had to do this, or at least a fair amount of them. Nicole, can you play that clip for me?
While we may be a nation divided on policies, we are a country that stands united in condemning hate and evil in all of its very ugly forms.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence. It has no place in America. Racism is evil. And those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans.
And you had people, and I'm not talking about the neo-Nazis and the white nationalists, because they should be condemned totally.
The vile, hate-filled poison of anti-Semitism must be condemned and confronted everywhere and anywhere it appears. There must be no tolerance for anti-Semitism in America or for any form of religious or racial hatred or prejudice.
He's hesitating. You hear that hesitation in his voice? Oh my God, this guy is falling. I don't know of anybody who's had it rough than that guy. I don't know who anybody, any political figure, except for maybe Obama, who has had it that rough from a particular media set. We got to take a quick break, by the way. I'm Jack Stein. I'm filling in for Mr. Dory Monson. And it's going to be the next hour coming up. We're going to do the fastest 15. Going to get to a whole litany of people reacting to what's going on with the town hall debates, a whole litany of people having opinions about that. I'm Jack Stein, filling in for Mr. Dory Monson. Going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.